Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, you may have already decided who deserves Best Picture or Best Actor at this Sunday's 96th Academy Awards. But what about Best Cinematography or Best Editing? These craft categories reward the hard work and creativity behind the scenes that are central to bringing a story to life. And this hour, we'll meet four artists who can tell us what makes a film set or costume exceptional, or how to appreciate a bold edit or brilliant camera work. And we want to hear from you. What's an unsung Oscar category you'd love to know more about? Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The most popular Oscar categories are, yes, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Picture, but many people deserve credit for the profound impact of the films we love to celebrate, like the costume designers, editors, cinematographers, and production designers. And this hour, we get to meet some of these behind-the-scenes artists who shape how a film looks and feels on screen, its pacing, and whether or not we become immersed in the story. Joining me first are Sam Restivo and Ali Pierce. Ali is a costume designer whose credits include Paint, Clerks 3, and Black Bear. Welcome to Forum, Ali Pierce.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Sam Restivo is an editor whose films include Raised by Wolves and House of Gucci, and one that's up for three Oscars Sunday, Napoleon. Glad to have you with us as well, Sam.
Happy to be here. Very nice to meet you.
So, Sam, I understand there was just a ton of footage to edit down for Napoleon. I mean, I assume there's always a lot of editing involved in any film, but why more than usual for Napoleon?
Right, exactly. Well, so I'm very lucky to get to work with Ridley Scott, and he's a big proponent of using as many cameras as possible to kind of cover things from as many different angles, and also to always catch the magic of things that happen that aren't too rehearsed or whatnot. And so with a film like Napoleon, where you're dealing with all of these huge battle scenes, he would frequently shoot with 9 to 10 cameras on everything. Wow. And we would get probably on average around 2.5 or 3 hours worth of footage per day. And it's just, it can be a whole lot to go through, but it really saves us for getting to solve any problems and then just putting the puzzle piece of the movie together.
So you were sorting through whatever 9 or 10 cameras took on any given day. How did you deal with all of that footage without getting overwhelmed?
Well, exactly right. Because so this Napoleon was my first opportunity where I was promoted to get to be the lead or a co-editor on a movie of this size. I work along with this this legendary editor. Her name is Claire Simpson, and she wanted to give me this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so as someone who's trying to come up to get to do this, you could look at it as like, oh, my God, this is terrifying. Ridley Scott and, you know, umpteen cameras and all this, where the only way for me to survive is to embrace it and be excited. Like, you know, the 15-year-old kid in myself that dreamed of doing this. So when I got to do like the Battle of Waterloo, for example, and we're trying to decide, well, during this moment, the horses are charging down the meadow here. Well, it'd be great if we had like a wide tracking shot that goes along them. Well, guess what? It's Ridley Scott. So of course we have it. So it was an embarrassment of riches.
Oh, that's awesome. So yeah, talk about how you decide what to cut or when you're facing a tough call in terms of something to edit, how you make it.
Right. And so that's our eternal struggle, of course. And we knew with a movie like Napoleon, we're talking about a huge amount of history, of course, and we can't fit everything in. And in my mind, the best edited films are the ones where you're taking the audience for a ride, an entertaining, informative ride for exactly the right amount of time. Now, that can be 90 minutes, that can be 2 hours, it can be 3.5 hours. It just depends. And so we struggled with that greatly on Napoleon. time because there was just so much history and so many scenes. And ultimately, we decided to focus as much as we could on the relationship between Napoleon and Josephine. Mm-hmm. And that's how we landed.
Right. And so when you are looking at all of that footage, you're trying to determine what pieces of this are really contributing to that central theme, like of the relationship, for example.
Yes, absolutely. And thankfully, we had two fantastic actors in Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby to just give us so many, another embarrassment of riches, so many different options for us to go with. And then for all of us to be on the same page, too, about the tone of the film, while we were wanting to lean in to this kind of, not sarcastic, but, a satire of Napoleon.
So what are some movies that stand out to you, previous movies, that you think have exceptional editing? I'm so curious, what is being rewarded? What is being looked at as, wow, that's an example of great editing?
Well, that's a fascinating thing because movies can be any type of experience for the audience member. And I always point to, for me, these two films came out in the same year in 1991, and they had wildly different editing styles. And I think they're two of the greatest edited films of all time. One is Oliver Stone's JFK. That was edited by my good friend Joe Hutching and by Pietro Scalia. And what they did in that film was actually very revolutionary editing because they were trying to, they as well had a lot of history to get through and a lot of different film formats and just so much information, and they took a really ingenious approach of combining the picture and the sound and the music to create something that was an amazing, gripping experience. Like, I mean, I think about the scene on a park bench between Kevin Costner and Donald Sutherland. It's just two guys talking, but it's the most riveting thing ever. And then I contrast that with the same year The Silence of the Lambs came out, edited by Craig McKay. And that movie is a beautifully, formalistically edited film where they do everything exactly the right way and sustain the tension with these really long takes and staring directly at the characters. And I saw it when I was a kid on video, and I was absolutely terrified. It's one of the best movies ever.
We're talking with Sam Restivo, an editor whose credits include Napoleon, House of Gucci, and The Last Duel. We're talking about the Oscars craft categories and artists who shape these behind-the-scenes creative moments that make a film so, so memorable. We've also got Allison Pierce with us, costume designer, and I definitely want to talk costume design. We've already got some listener questions also asking about costume design. But, one of the things that costume design is known for, right, is either being really incredible, obvious, and bold, or being not noticeable at all. I've heard both things described as good costume design, so I'm curious, Allie, how you define good costume design.
Oh, wow. Well, I think when I was, learning about what a costume designer is, I was sort of taught that we're supposed to support the actor's performance and support the character and allow the audience to kind of, seamlessly blend into the story and, not be distracting. I think when you think of like a period film or fantasy, the costumes are definitely the forefront, and that's usually what gets nominated for an Oscar. For me, it's about creating costumes and building characters that blend into the world that the DP, the production designer, the director, the writer, we're all creating together, and it all needs to mesh and make sense. And I feel like if I'm doing that, I'm doing my job well.
How do you get started? How do you go about designing costumes for a film?
I mean, it depends what the project is. For the most part, I read the script and then I kind of decide which characters I want to focus on first. There's usually a fair amount of research involved, no matter what the time period is, because, when I'm reading a script, I'm visualizing what I think the characters would look like. And in order to share that language with the director and the actor, I need to find other visuals to put boards together. So I'm usually thinking about the color palette. Who the actor is playing the role is important, where they shop, what they do for a living, where they live geographically, what their interests are. All those things inform, how they dress.
What is one of the most challenging films or characters that you had to do costume design for?
Oh, geez. I mean, I worked on Saturday Night Live for four seasons, and I was lucky enough to be there during the election cycle. I was there from 2015 to 2019.
Oh, wow.
And though that was like very quick turnover, you know, when you're designing a film, you might not see your work on screen for years. But when I was working at Saturday Night Live as one of the costume designers, we would shoot Thursday, Friday, and then I would see it on TV on Saturday. And I was able to learn very quickly from what worked and what didn't. I think I'm trying to think of like what a challenging, they were all challenging, to be honest. but I mean, it was always like Al Sharpton walks on camera, Keenan's Al Sharpton. It would always be something random and very specific. Actually, whenever we were recreating like Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, that was very challenging because anyone who's a political figure, parody is so different than, you know, designing a narrative that doesn't exist. Parody is like its own beast. And if you mess up the pin that Hillary Clinton wore during a debate, that's what people are going to find fault in. And I think doing that research is totally different and really important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm struck by something you said earlier, which is that period films, you know, maybe fantasy, I'm thinking like sci-fi or space, that those, you know, big and bold uses of costume often are what get rewarded at the Oscars. So does that mean that costumers who work in more subtle ways have a harder time getting recognition?
Yes, definitely. I think, you know, there are a lot of costume designers that mostly work in contemporary. I've done both period and contemporary. And I think that for the most part, when people think about costume design, they're really thinking about, you know, the period film like Napoleon or Killers of the Flower Moon. And that's kind of what stands out to them. I mean, I think that there are different ways to tell a story, and contemporary can be really interesting as far as costume design goes. When you think of, maybe like a show like Mare of Easttown, where, you know, it's like a slice of this little town in Pennsylvania, and the costume design is so specific and aged and distressed and needs to look really gritty and geographically accurate to that location. And contemporary designers have the opportunity to kind of show the audience this one little world that they might not see.
We're talking to some of the behind-the-scenes artists who shape how a film looks and feels on screen. Allie Pierce, a costume designer, Sam Restivo, an editor. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What questions do you have about the behind-the-scenes creativity that goes into a film? What are films you've watched where the costumes or the production, editing, or cinematography were memorable to you in a good way? Conversely, when was it not so much? You can email your comments and questions to forum at kqed.org. Find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. You can also give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Understanding the behind-the-scenes work that goes into a film deepens our enjoyment and appreciation of it, and often our understanding of the story. And so with the Oscars this Sunday, we're taking a moment to appreciate the craft categories, things like editing and costume design, with editor Sam Restivo and costume designer Allison Pierce, and with you, our listeners, sharing with us the questions that you have about the creativity that goes on during a film, the artists who are responsible for so much of the core work that shapes the mood, the feel of a story. And also, when it hasn't gone so well for you, this listener writes, I loved The Green Book, but the editing was horrible. In close-up scenes, the cross necklace would be tucked inside the shirt, then dangling free, then tucked. The cigarette ash grew and shrunk randomly. Buttons would be buttoned, then open, then buttoned. If the editing is good, it is transparent. If it is bad, it detracts from the film. And another listener, Noel, writes on Discord, sound design, it's in the background and kind of works subliminally. I would like to see Zone of Interest, and sound plays a huge role. I've heard that's a behind-the-scenes category that Noel would love to know more about. And of course, listeners, you can share that as well. What's an Oscar category you'd love to learn more about, how it functions in the making of a film. I want to turn now actually to cinematography and production design. And for that, we have Olivia Peebles with us, a production designer whose credits include Miss Juneteenth, Killers of the Flower Moon, Oppenheimer, and Titus Kaphar's upcoming Sundance film, Exhibiting Forgiveness. It played at Sundance, I believe. Olivia, thanks so much for being with us.
Mina, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And also with us is Elijah Christian, a cinematographer whose credits include The Night House and The Voyeurs. Elijah, also really glad to have you on as well.
Thanks so much, Mina. I appreciate it.
So, Olivia, let me start with you. I have heard production or set design described as the art of building worlds. And I wonder if you like that description, if you feel like it's accurate.
I do. I feel like it means many things. And I will say, so I work in production design and set decoration, which are all under the umbrella of production design. And that is creating the visual world and working with, you know, the other keys, much like Ali said, we work with our director, our costume designer, our cinematographer, our gaffer, who's in charge of the lighting. And we work to establish a visual language. And from there, we use that language to tell the story to the best of our ability.
So thinking about, wow, when you say building worlds, like all of that information, the architecture that's around the, I don't know, just all the lines and distinct visual elements that set a scene, yeah. Essentially?
Yeah, we work with sort of many different media. We have architecture plays a huge part for sure, but also fine little details. You know, with set decoration, we'll often think about character, what's motivating furniture. You know, a lot of what Ali said about costume design really stuck with me because it really is about character building. And, you know, we often get down to the detail of what kind of pencil this character would have in their desk drawer, you know, something, what motivates these objects to exist in these character spaces? Why would they be there? And it's really a fun ride every time.
So I understand for Killers of the Flower Moon, essentially, it required building an entire town. Can you talk about what that's like?
Yes, I was very fortunate. I worked on that film as the assistant decorator, and I worked with decorator Adam Willis and production designer Jack Fisk, who, you know, has a very, very artistic outlook on production design. And that film was very research-based. And you know, we went to the town of Pawhuska, and once we realized that there were a lot of structures that hadn't really changed since the time period, we recreated storefronts based on history. A lot of the research that we found of the town of Fairfax, and we tried to recreate that there in Pawhuska. And, you know, there were a couple of building facades that were built, like a hotel and a movie theater. But a lot of the structures there, we were given a gift of these places, these buildings that have existed there for so long since our time period in the early 20s. And so we worked to create storefronts with set decoration and an art direction, you know, honing in a color scheme and, really trying to create the world that existed as it was then.
Yeah. You mentioned it was very research-based, and I've heard you say that the most fundamental thing in production design is research. And I'm curious, what you mean by that. Why is that something that you think it all boils down to?
I think because I believe research to be, it's all inclusive. We observe. So, you know, from, like Ali was saying, period pieces often get recognized because you can see the work, you see the designer's hand in it. But research is everything. It's story driven, it's character driven. And I think that for me, research is so essential in helping to create that visual language that you're communicating with your team. And everyone, I think that looking at images really helps people to be unified behind that same vision.
I see. Yeah. So something that is consistent, and the only way that you can probably come up with that is if you have a lot that you have looked at that creates that kind of immersive and authentic sort of scene or environment that you are trying to create. You were also set decorator for the New Mexico unit for the film Oppenheimer. What was that like?
That was an incredible and wild experience. We were up against a lot. The New Mexico portion in particular, we had a lot of challenges with weather. It was really, really extreme out in the desert. And so, you know, we have creative challenges always, but that film was technically very challenging. We had to drive, you know, an hour and a half to get out into these desert sets. And we sort of never knew, no matter how protected we could make the sets, what condition they'd be in the next day. We had tents that would blow overnight. It was just, the weather was so extreme. It was, honestly, it became part of the story. It became a character in the film, which was very accurate.
We're talking production design with Olivia Peebles, who worked on Killers of the Flower Moon and Oppenheimer, as well as Miss Juneteenth and Exhibiting Forgiveness. Sam Restivo is also with us, who is an editor, Allison Pierce, a costume designer. And we have cinematographer Elijah Christian with us. And Elijah, welcome to Forum. Thanks so much for being with us. And also, I know that this is probably a question you may get a lot, but just for our listeners who may not know, what does a cinematographer do?
Thanks, Mina. A cinematographer basically tries to make the director's vision a reality in terms of the camera language and the lighting. So, you know, it is really working in conjunction with these other departments to bring the cinema or the director's vision to life.
You've said that filmmaking is all about limitations, understanding limitations. How does that influence or relate to your approach to cinematography?
Well, every film is different, and you have to go in knowing, you know, what you can accomplish or what you should set out to accomplish, you know, with the time and the budget that you have. So, you know, whether it's a giant epic superhero movie or a small intimate story, you know, the time that you have and the money that you have is going to dictate what you can do with that, you know, with that story. So, you know, you have to hone your approach to basically cater to the time and the money that you have. And so you have to sort of implement these limitations, and ultimately you can use them to your advantage.
What are some examples of cinematography that you really appreciate or admire, Elijah?
There's so many. It's such a loaded question. I think, I think what really inspired me to get into this originally was Gordon Willis's work on The Godfather. And just the extreme look of that film and how dark he was willing to go, and just the depth and the shadows, that really has stuck with me. And then slightly more contemporary, Harris Savitas is a big influence on me, more naturalistic and also a very dark approach.
Interesting that you bring up dark. One of the things I've been asked is if cinematography is always about lighting. Like when the Academy is awarding best cinematography, they're really awarding the lighting department. Would you say that's true?
It's definitely partially true. I think so cinematography, you know, it is lighting and camera working together, but the cinematographer works very closely with the gaffer and the key grip. You know, the gaffer is in charge of the lighting department. The key grip is in charge of the grip department, and the grips are more on the shaping side of the lighting. So, you know, it's like you have a light coming in, but you need to shape it so that it hits what you want and you can keep it off of certain things that you want to keep in the shadows. And so it's really those three people who work together to accomplish the lighting.
So Elijah, I was reading some of the critical acclaim that you got for your cinematography work on The Night House, for example, which is a supernatural mystery from 2021, particularly in the way you conjured spectral presences. Can you just describe a little bit about how you went about doing that?
Yeah, that was a challenge, definitely, because the kind of the monster in the movie is basically it's nothing. So it's like, how do you visualize nothing?
Yeah.
So it's a real struggle to, you know, to brainstorm and to just sort of bring shape to something that is so amorphous. But I think that ultimately, we figured out that if we could build in the shape of a man into objects in this house, then, you know, we could portray somebody watching her in the shadows. And, you know, that was really working with the production designer on that, and the art director and the prop master to figure out how to build the set so it's at a certain angle you would see this outline of a man.
I was going to say, if you were using objects and architecture to try to conjure that, you must have to work very intimately with the production designer, people like Olivia Peebles.
Yes, absolutely. No, production design and, you know, for that matter, costume design, and they're just so crucial. It's, you know, you can have the best cinematographer in the world, but if you don't have a beautiful set, if you don't have the costumes, like, you're not shooting anything. So you really have to work together, and you work with them and with the director on, you know, the look and the feel, and the production design absolutely informs the cinematography.
We're talking with cinematographer Elijah Christian, whose credits include The Voyeurs and The Night House. We're talking with Olivia Peebles, who was production designer on Exhibiting Forgiveness and also has worked on Killers of the Flower Moon and Oppenheimer. Allie Pierce was costume designer, whose credits include Clerks 3, Paint and Black Bear, and Sam Restivo, editor, whose credits include Napoleon, House of Gucci, and The Last Duel. And your listeners can ask them any questions you want about their craft. Share your experiences about noticing, in a good way or a not so good way, some of the things that were these sort of behind the scenes elements that were supposed to really enhance and support the story. Maybe there's an Oscar category you'd love to know more about. You can email forum@kqed.org. Find us on our social channels on X, Instagram, or our digital community on Discord. We're at KQED Forum. And you can call us 866-733-6786. Okay, we've had a lot of questions building up, so let me go to them right now. Mark in Riverside, you're on.
Hey, first of all, let me just say I'm kind of geeking out pretty hardcore for all three of you. I don't think people understand how crucial and the layers that you guys add to a movie. I mean, from set to wardrobe to location, and it really is extraordinary. And I think when you're so good at what you do, I'll get to my question. I just only have a moment to say this. I want to make sure you know how much I appreciate all of you. My question is for Allie, by the way. I just don't think people understand that when you're watching a movie and you're very good at what you do, people take it for granted because they immediately get immersed in the environment. And that's literally hats off to you three. So my question to I'm so geeking out, guys. I'm 54 and I feel like a kid right now. Bear with me. So my question is to Allie. When you're nailing the wardrobe and the actors are putting on, you know, their clothes and whatever that fits the period that you worked so hard and so diligently to do, and the same kind of question I guess goes to the other two, but mainly Allie right now, is I know for a fact, theory, that the actors have to feel more engrossed, more committed to the character once they put your wardrobe on that you've added to their character. So I just wanted to know, do they appreciate you and do they thank you?
Thanks, Mark. Allie, do the actors appreciate your work as much as maybe what Mark is worried about? They don't realize how much you deserve.
I found that, well, firstly, you know, costume designers are often the first face of the production when an actor comes to location when we're going to shoot something. So I'm usually the first person they see besides the director department-wise, and they really start to feel like they're becoming the character in the first fitting, especially if what I'm bringing to the fitting makes sense and resonates with the actor. And that's when they really start to get into the role. And, you know, I've heard that feedback many times, and it's really rewarding to feel such a part of the actor's process. I think that, secondly, the most successful and wonderful to work with actors are the ones who really know that the costume and the wardrobe team are, like, there to support them and need to be treated with respect and as equals as well.
Well, you have another question from Suze, who writes, I have a student who's interested in costume design. I'd love to hear how one prepares for that career in the film industry.
I mean, I think there's lots of different ways to go about it. I went to Parsons and I thought I wanted to do fashion, and I kind of decided quickly that wasn't for me. And I had some friends who were in film school, and I just started to kind of loiter around sets when they were filming things. And I discovered that costume design, you know, was a career path that I could take. I've always been into making something out of nothing and sourcing materials and thrifting and, you know, what I call Frankensteining of garments that exist. And that's something you can do kind of like in your own time and with not a huge budget, with found objects, to make characters come to life.
We're talking about the craft categories at the Oscars awards, things like production design, costume design, editing, and cinematography, with four artists in these fields, and we'll have more with them and with you after the break. You are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Star One Credit Union provides you with the tech, tools, and terms to control your money and your lifestyle. Simple, seamless, everyday financial services and solutions. Online and mobile banking backed by the latest technology. Great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. And real people providing real assistance when you need it. At Star One, they always put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or visit any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union. In your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the awards categories at the Oscars that bring a story to life as much as the actors who draw the spotlight. With us is Elijah Christian, a cinematographer, Olivia Peebles, a production designer, Allie Pierce, a costume designer, and Sam Restivo, an editor. And of course, you, our listeners, are with us sharing your questions and comments about what makes a film magical to you and the kinds of craft and artistry that go into it. This listener writes, until I became a fan of the show Outlander, I never paid much attention to the background categories you're talking about today. But in between seasons of the show, I started watching behind-the-scenes interviews about how the show is edited, the detail that goes into set design, designing costumes, choosing fabric and a color palette for the show, or a particular scene. It has made me realize just how important all of the behind-the-scenes work is in making a difference to how interesting a show or a movie is. Good acting can take a TV show or movie a long way, but if all the behind-the-scenes work isn't there, it will not have staying power. And listener Ross writes, I've always wondered how film editing relates to the final vision. It would seem editing has a deep impact on the tone and mood of the film. A few frames here or there could do it. Do film editors have creative freedom in this sense, or do directors rely on them for the emotional fine points? Huh. Sam, what do you think? How much creative freedom do you have?
Right. So it depends on the relationship between the director and the editor. And in this particular case with something like Napoleon, Ridley really, so he's got a huge vision for the movie. And so we communicate with him before the film starts. So we have the screenplay, and then we have his hand-drawn storyboards that he does for every film. And so that's kind of a roadmap for us to kind of know what's what in the order of things. But then he kind of lets us run wild with it. And it's during this initial assembly phase where we get to do so much creative work in deciding, you know, which direction tonally we're going to go. And for a film like Napoleon, we got to do a lot of decision making about the music choices, because there were a ton of pre-existing classical pieces that we got to use. And that often informed kind of if you're meant to laugh during a scene or you're meant to be riveted by a scene. So I would say, yeah, it's all about the relationship with the director. But in our case, he let us kind of run wild for a time with it. So it was fabulous.
Let me go to caller Barbara in San Francisco. Hi, Barbara, you're on.
Oh, thank you so much. I came upon the shooting of a movie in the Bay Area at Tamales one day. And it was fascinating to me what a great team effort it was. I kept my modern car out of sight, of course, to not ruin the period of it. They covered Highway 1 with gravel, and they had, I remember as a prop, an old gasoline pump, a cylindrical gas pump. I know that that's away from maybe the 40s. I think they were trying to recreate the 40s, if I'm correct. But
yeah.
I was very impressed. And, of course, we had to keep totally quiet when they said action. And they kept cutting. But it took so many retakes to get that one little scene.
Well, Barbara, thanks for sharing your experience. And, you know, Olivia, obviously Barbara could appreciate the production design, the set design, the props, and all those kinds of things that were going into creating that kind of scene. And I believe it's true. When you learn more about these things, you really do appreciate the film and understand the story better. Just in preparing for this, I felt that way as I was learning more about each of these craft categories. So is there a way for moviegoers, or what would you recommend for a casual moviegoer to do, maybe to pay a little more attention or recognize excellent production design?
I think that just understanding how many people are involved in this creative vision, and that there is an intentionality behind every decision for the most part. Of course, one of the most important rules of filmmaking is to be adaptable. You know, for example, that's a great, I'm very happy that you got to see a set out in the world, because we have to respond to things that are happening around us. And there are always different challenges and challenges that you think you're prepared for. And sometimes new things come up and you have to adapt on the day. But I do think that just knowing that somebody put things there for a reason or took things out for a reason is a really helpful way to understand production design 101.
Well, the sister Matt writes, please ask Elijah to elaborate on how he uses the limitations of budget, time, etc., to his and the film's advantage. We were talking earlier, Elijah, about how you said it's so much about limitations. Matt's wondering how you use that to your advantage.
Well, I think you just use the limitations to inform the way that you tell the story. So it might be, you know, if you're working with a smaller crew and a lower budget, it might be limiting you know, the scope of the camera, or, you know, it all has to be based on story overall, but I think you also have to you don't want to have infinite choices, because then if you do, you're not going to be able to pick a direction. So if you can sort of make, I call it like making rules for yourself, and that's something done in preparation, you know, with the director, but it's, let's, you know, really focus on this character and only see things from her perspective, or really limit the scope of what you're getting, knowing that, you know, you have, I think on any movie, you know, we all want more time, we all want more money, so that we can, like, you know, make a more grand story, or, you know, like really pull off the vision we have in our heads. But there's always limitations. And so you have to be able to work within those and really find your way through the limitations to actually make something impactful.
I like your point about how limitations and how it sort of basically determines, you know, that you will have fewer choices as a good thing, right? That having fewer choices to have to make, reframing that as something that can be an advantage, is an interesting way of using limitations and seeing your way through that to make a project really succeed. Let me go to caller Mary Beth in Healdsburg, who's on the line. Mary Beth, join us.
Hi, thank you. This question is for costume design, but I realize it's for set design as well. Possibly in the last decade or so, I've noticed, especially in period pieces, the first time I noticed it was a movie I can't remember, set in the 1950s, where the color palette of the clothing is this tonal, deep, rich teal color, different shades of a deep teal, you know, greenish blue, and it seems to be in place of neutral gray or brown or black. Recently, I've noticed it in Miss Scarlet and the Duke. And my first question was, asked myself, was that a popular color in the 1950s? But then when I started seeing it more often in more movies, I started to wonder, you know, what that was all about. And so that's my question for you.
Huh. Mary Beth, thanks. It's interesting. Allison, like, are color trends or even modern color trends something that we see in films, or do they exist in multiple, are they influencing multiple costumes or sets in films?
Definitely. I mean, especially if you're talking about, you know, something set in 1956, you're going to look at like what the colors of the year were. When you're talking about fashion, like for the most part, if I'm designing something that's set in like 1995, I'm looking at what was in magazines or what designers, like fashion designers, were doing a few years before, and that would inform what people were wearing, like the general population. But I want to say I'm looking at Miss Scarlet and the Duke, at the costume that she's referring to, and it actually looks like different colors in different screenshots, which is really interesting, because that's very important for me as a costume designer, is speaking with Elijah, the cinematographer, about what the lighting will be for each scene. And that informs the way colors look on actors. And if it's not, you know, accurate, it's not what the color actually is in real life, it can be very confusing from scene to scene, looking different.
This listener wants to know, and I think this one is for you, Olivia, how do you find the objects for a set, especially for historical films? Do you replicate the antiques? Are they real? What do you do with the sets once you've finished? Also, how on earth can I get that job?
I think one of the best parts about filmmaking is that it is different every time. So I work with a set decorator who often has shoppers or assistants who sort of scour every corner of the earth for whatever object we may need. And I think we find inspiration in those shopping trips sometimes. So often when I'm starting a project, I will send somebody out or go out myself, which is when I have time, it's the absolute best, and photograph vendors and stores. You know, it can be antique stores, thrift stores. We sometimes use prop houses. Sometimes we fabricate things, but we create a catalog of everything that is sort of available to us. And then we pull from there over time as we start to dress each set and figure out what our budget is looking like. But yeah, I mean, sometimes we go into some pretty crazy places. Like on Killers of the Flower Moon, our shoppers really went to almost every state. And we would meet people in antique stores who say, you know, I got a friend who's got something in their basement and I think it might be of interest to you. So you wind up going to that guy's house and going into his basement and seeing this, you know, amazing chair that he has that hasn't been touched since 1890. And it's phenomenal. And you just find yourself in the coolest and strangest places. Sometimes we'll be location scouting and we're in a home and we see something that is just so perfect and it sticks with us. And we may not wind up shooting there, but sometimes you reach back out to that person and say, hey, can I rent your chair? It's fantastic. And I think it's a really, really fun thing to just be around so many objects and figure out how they fit into your story.
We are taking your questions on set design, production design, costume design, editing, cinematography with cinematographer Elijah Christian, production designer Olivia Peebles, costume designer Allie Pierce, editor Sam Restivo. And let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I like this questioner from a listener on Discord who writes, who actually makes up the voting body of the Academy? And do your guests trust their expertise when voting for these craft categories? So, Elijah, let me go to you on that. So in the cinematography category, for example, this year it's El Conde, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. I don't know if you saw any of those films and feel like you can speak to this, but I am curious if you feel like, yes, those are definitely standout films that deserve a nod from the Academy. Or do you think it's a little not always totally based in the skills and expertise of the people who work in these things?
No, I think all of those films are definitely worthy of a nomination. Absolutely. And yeah, I think with, you know, there's campaigns that are run to prop movies up or to get attention. So there's definitely a bit of, you know, a bit of the showmanship involved and that actually, does influence who gets a nomination. But that being said, I think all of those films, like the work is absolutely amazing. And I think, you know, the hard thing is that you're limited on who gets recognized, right? Because, you know, you have that handful of films, but there are so many other stunning films that were made last year.
Yeah, there always are so many that don't end up making these small, short lists. Do you want to say if there's one that particularly stood out to you and why? I mean, you don't necessarily have to say which one you think should win, but you're welcome to do that as well.
I really can't pick, honestly. I think I know what will win.
What do you think will win?
Well, I just think that Oppenheimer is such a force this year. And I mean, Hoyte is an absolute genius, a cinematographer. I mean, I've been a fan of his for such a long time. And so I mean, it deserves what it wins, of course.
Yeah.
But it's the thing to beat this year.
What is in the cinematography in particular, one thing that you think is what makes it stand out as we're helping our listeners learn to appreciate what to look for in Oppenheimer that Hoyte does?
Oof. Man, it's so hard to quantify. I think what's so impressive about what Hoyte and Nolan do together is, you know, they're adamant about shooting on film. They shoot on this large format film, these huge IMAX cameras, and they do their visual effects. They do that work in camera. So it's not computer driven effects. So that's just, you know, on a practical level, it's so much harder, but I really appreciate when a movie is shot in camera as much as possible.
Well, Morgan writes, Oppenheimer in 70 millimeter was stunning and magically immersive. The editing particularly stood out for me. It made me feel like I was inhabiting the world of the narrative. Let me go to caller Jaime in San Francisco. Jaime, you're on.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We've been hearing a lot about the visual impact that photography and cinematography has, but we haven't talked much about the sounds and location sounds or post-production sounds added to the film. So this is directly going to the comment made by one of your guests about the importance of doing research, and in particular the nature, sounds of nature. So I'm an ornithologist, and I pay attention a lot about the bird songs and the calls, and I really get annoyed when I see a movie and there's like the desert scene and there's like a vulture flying and there is a sound of a red-tailed hawk, or you know, the people running into the jungle in South Africa, and I hear songs of Amazonian birds. So those things really are a disappointment for someone who is trying to get the sense of the environment and the movie. And those little things really, you know, they let me down. And I remember those movies.
Yeah.
Because these opportunities, you know, it's like a little of a lack of attention to the detail. So how much of this type of sound and you know, very, very in the research aspect, particularly about is paying attention more lately, and do you have like a someone that is doing this kind of work, or versus just bring me the sound of you know, of nature and just press play?
Sorry to cut you off, Jaime, but yeah, we're coming up towards the end of the hour. I'm not sure in terms of who among you, maybe Sam or Olivia, where the sound is something that you really have to be thinking about in terms of its accuracy and the way it works in a film. Maybe Sam, I'll go to you first really quick.
Yeah, absolutely. We rely so much, by the way, on all of the different production departments, costumes, production design, and cinematography as well. But on a movie like Napoleon, our on-set mixer, Stefan Butcher, was in contact with us before the movie started about the different sounds that we were going to need for these various locations and during these time periods in history. And so we start from that point with a fabulous production sound, and then we know when we're starting to put the film, the layers of the sound together, we want it to be as accurate as possible. So we do lean heavily on our supervising sound designers and the sound editors to do as much as they can.
Yeah, and you're reminding me, as we said at the beginning, there are so many different categories that deserve so much attention. I am so grateful that we got to hear about editing, costume design, production design, and cinematography today. Thank you, Elijah Christian. Thank you, Olivia Peoples and Ali Pierce and Sam Restivo, for being on with us today. Thank you, listeners, for all of your great questions and comments, and for reminding us, as always, just how important these behind-the-scenes categories are. Mark Nieto produced today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.